Hi, welcome to another episode of the Man Reimagined podcast. My name is Richard Ayling, and normally I'd be saying hello to my friend and co-host Malcolm in this moment, but as he was in Argentina when I had the conversation I'm about to share with you, I'll say hello for him as he sits this one out. So today I'm bringing you a conversation I had last week with Paul Robson. Paul is not new to the podcast. In episode 35, I interviewed him in his home. I was staying with him directly after I finished one of my men's retreats, and he knew I was in the area and kindly invited me to come and stay with him and his family. And that conversation is really an exploration of me trying to understand how someone can go from being an atheist to converting to Orthodox Christianity, what that would give somebody, and what place that has religion has, if any, in the world of men's work. It's a really interesting conversation. It was really me trying, you know, to kind of understand that world. So if you find that an interesting topic, please go check it out. I reached out to him a good year and a half later, you know, that's kind of where we are now, to kind of check in and see where he is now, because at the time he really wanted to keep religion and men's work separate. And from what I could tell, kind of looking him up online since then, it seems like a little bit of that has bled over. Some of the conversations he's having with these podcast guests, you know, are fathers, and he's bringing that in and more embracing this tradition that he's chosen. And so I really want to understand, well, why the U-turn, how does this play a role? And it's one of the many kind of conversations and topics that we dive into. I want to understand more about his current thinking of what masculinity means for him, what restoring manhood and masculinity looks like in his world. I do this because Paul is someone that I met about 3 or 4 years ago at the European Men's Gathering. And he's actually one of the kind of founding members of the modern European men's movement. He's got a strong voice, and him and I originally kind of didn't really quite get each other. But I have such an admiring respect for him and the way he thinks. I like his honesty. I find him refreshingly direct. And so I kind of wanted to just deepen the conversation, reawaken it, so to speak, because I really had a great time a year and a half ago. And I think that his voice is one that you may not agree with all of the time. And certainly with the angle of Orthodox Christianity and what that means for him, what marriage means for him, that might not land with you. But I think it's important to hear many voices from across the spectrum, and it's an episode that I hope you enjoy. I got a lot of value out of. Afterwards, he kind of was he mentioned how he had expected me to maybe jump in and give him maybe a bit more of pushback in certain areas. So that's good feedback that I was sort of very accommodating. So if you find that I am in this conversation, yeah. You're welcome to let me know as well if you'd like me to give more pushback and to challenge people as I get to know them. But my position that there's enough pushback, there's enough conflict, there's enough contentious conversations where people aren't really listening to understand each other. And so that's really what I try to model here as best I can. Although, of course, I can also go too far the other way. So without further ado and any more kind of reflections from me, I bring you this interview with Paul Robson, and I hope you enjoy it. All righty. Welcome, Paul. Thank you so much for taking the time to rejoin me after about a year and a half since our last conversation. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Richard. It's great to see you again.
Likewise, for those that haven't checked out the former podcast, I mean, I'll have already spoken to it in the intro notes. Today, I'm looking to kind of catch up with you and find out where you are as a human, and also in regards to religion, because you back then made a point of saying, I want to kind of keep men's work and my religion kind of quite separate. And there's been an about turn in that way, which really interests me. And it brings up this question of how religion fits into men's work, why there's such a big draw to it now. And I'm just really curious about diving into where men's work is at and then the state of the world and whatever else kind of comes up. So maybe we can start just by, I'm just going to ask, like, how have you been in the last year and a half and kind of what's happened to you significantly that's made you, that's taken you where you are in terms of men's work and religion?
Well, big thing that happened in life is that my third son was born. His name is Johannes. He's just about to turn, or he's 1 month from being 1 year old now. So that's obviously been a bit of a process for our family to get used to and settling in more with that. And also then 4 years ago, me and my wife moved out into the countryside from living in Copenhagen. And so I'd also say there's been a process of finding our feet in a more peaceful setting as well, where we're far more connected to kind of practical realities of having to, like, you know, deal with, you know, a mouse breaking into our house, or, you know, needing to do insulation on, it's a 360-year-old farmhouse, and, you know, things break and stuff like that, and you have to sort out things yourself, you know, when it's cold and wintry, then you feel it a lot more. So we're much more in contact with reality, where I think what we really see is how in the big city, living in Copenhagen, there's a very different culture and a different way of being in life, and it feels far more natural and organic the way that we are together as a family, living out here, which has been really, really good for us as a family. So yeah, that's on the kind of practical side of life. And then you asked specifically about religion. We'll talk about more about, like, men's work and religion, yeah, so for people who don't know it, I kind of came through most of my adult life being an atheist. I'm 42 years old today. And about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, perhaps now, I converted to Christianity after being an atheist for a long time. And that's been a journey for me that continues to deepen. I'm studying theology with an online seminary over an Orthodox seminary. So I'm an Orthodox Christian. We just celebrated the Annunciation, which is the kind of Gabriel coming to the Mary and announcing to her that she will give birth to Christ, to the Savior, through a virgin birth. So we just had that celebration this Sunday, this week. We were out on a monastery out on a tiny little island here in Denmark. It was a beautiful and powerful experience to be a part of. So that continues to be a deepening in many ways as well, which is adding more value to my life and to my family's life as well. Yeah.
Maybe I'll just jump in to what you just said at the end there. That's really interesting to me, because, again, being an atheist myself with sort of spiritual leanings now quite strongly as well, and searching for, I think, rather lazily, a tradition. I'm fascinated by how you can move from this space that I identify with still to then not just kind of studying theology, but now taking part in these kind of rituals, which I can't see an immediate kind of association or benefit to. Like, is there a metaphor in there? Or when you talk about the celebration of Gabriel, yada, yada, it kind of washed over my head. So I'm like, and perhaps other people listening. So why is that now suddenly kind of meaningful to you? What do you get out of that? And perhaps that's the wrong question.
It's a really interesting question. It's a big and deep question. I'm actually just busy putting together a little script for a video on celebration and why we as humans celebrate stuff, because it's something that we've kind of maybe lost a bit of touch with. And perhaps we even, you know, have started, you know, kind of, it becomes more random what it is we celebrate and how we celebrate. We still celebrate our birthdays, of course, but we also, like, celebrate more, like, you know, pop events or kind of sporting events or something like that these days. Whereas before, obviously, the Christian story was the central thing that we celebrated. Interestingly, in Denmark, like, there used to be all of these holy days, like public holidays, which were based on the church calendar and the different things that were celebrating. So the whole of Danish society took a day off work for, you know, on, of course, Nativity and Easter, but also on all the different, there's 12 great feasts of the church. And so these used to be public holidays for the entire society. And then in Denmark recently, you know, over the years, they kind of collected all of these public holidays into one day, which they called the Great Prayer Day. And that was, I think, in May somewhere they did that. And then just last year, they decided to get rid of Great Prayer Day as well in order to raise more money to be able to send war and weapons and stuff like that down to Ukraine. That was the official reason given by the government why we need to get rid of Great Prayer Day so we can save more money for killing Russians in Ukraine, interestingly enough. So something we've lost touch with in our society is especially celebration of the Christian stories. I think you're not alone at all in having that wonder. And so as a Christian, then the way we see it is that all meaning in life is created through story. And stories follow these archetypical patterns. And the greatest story ever is the story of what we see as like is God uniting himself with man. So the story of Christ, we say, is God became man so that man can become God. So he kind of did that to show us the way to divinity. He became a human being so that human beings can then become united with him as well. And so every element of the Christian story is all kind of a part of that grand arc of that story. And that's why we celebrate all the different parts of it to create a structure in our own life. And it's something that repeats in cycles. There are, you know, several different cycles in the church. There's a daily cycle, there's a monthly cycle, there's a weekly cycle, there's a yearly cycle, and then there's the cycle of your entire lifetime as well, where there's specific things that happen in these different cycles. And so that creates structure and meaning in a lifetime somehow. Yeah,
that's a great answer. I think there was a standout of structure. You said celebration. I mean, maybe we can sort of tie in ceremony with that. You know, we don't really have so many these days, and they do seem to be kind of fairly arbitrary. And I like that because it gives us a sense of meaning and story in our lives. And arguably, we've kind of in secular society completely lost the story. We're not really planning ahead to the next generation, although arguably this is the one generation that needs to do the most. And you're actually kind of harking back in some way to these times where it was deemed important. And like, what do you actually get out of that when you go to these events? I mean, maybe that's a strange question, but I'm always trying to get to the granular of it. You know, there's a sense of community. There's like, you know, how is that experience for you, especially as someone that's kind of new to this? And you're kind of, do you feel like a bit of like an alien, or are you like, oh, this is interesting, what's going on here? Like,
yeah, I mean, well, we're diving straight into the deep end here, Richard, with some big questions that are not easy to put across, not easy to understand. I've been reading a whole lot from a guy called Father Seraphim Rose. So Father Seraphim Rose grew up, he was born in 1938 in California. I think it was in San Diego. And then he grew up very much in the kind of time of really large cultural shifts in California and the United States, specifically like the whole hippie generation revolution. And so he studied at Berkeley University and Ponoma College, which were these kind of like really elite, very left-wing kind of progressive universities, and was a student of Alan Watts when Alan Watts was at Berkeley, and took these, was really on a very serious search for truth in his life. And kind of went through this entire hippie movement and experimented with the psychedelics and the sexual kind of experimentation of his time. But through various things, which I won't detail, I've just read his 1,400-page biography, actually, which is absolutely amazing. He converted to Orthodox Christianity and became a monk. And so moved up together with one other guy to a very, very remote place up in the very, very northern parts of Northern California. And lived there without water, without electricity, for about 10, 20 years. They were printing a publication, which was like this old-fashioned printing press, where they had to put in the individual letters manually to like, they would like write an article by hand, and they'd like manually pull the letters, get in these like sheets, and then print, they're printing their little publication. This is like in the 60s and 70s, 80s. He died in 84, actually, or 82. And published this thing. Anyway, so this guy, Father Seraphim Rose, has just really spoken to my heart about exactly that question that you asked now. And it's not so easy to answer that question, but he has a talk which is called God's Revelation to the Human Heart. And it's something about is like the possibility for a human being to get in touch with the divine that he spoke about, and it's something that what he talks about is like, who does God reveals himself to? The loving human heart. So the heart that is open to a message of love is one that can be opened. But you'll hear this in all kinds of new age things as well. And this is something that Father Seraphim Rose was very, very aware of. And so in his talk, he spoke a lot about the possibility of spiritual deception, of opening yourself up to spiritual experiences and being misled and going down wrong paths. And the role of suffering in actually kind of bringing one closer to God. So he actually saw that it was going through suffering, which often led people to an intense and true, truthful experience, where it's often the pursuit of pleasure, which can lead one, or pleasure or pride or arrogance or like inflation of one's own ego or something like that. I've been very inspired by some of the things that he's been writing. I don't know if I can in any way explain it in the same way, but I can definitely say that it's worthwhile checking him out if someone is. Does that answer your question at all? I'm not sure.
It really does, because like I guess that's the failure in the question that I asked and my intent to try and understand something at a granular level that clearly is beyond that. You see what I mean? That's kind of what part of my search is trying to kind of reach. And I like the part that you mentioned around the struggle as a way to God. There's it's years ago, but there's like a TV show with a character, and it's a comedy, and he talks to his friend who's trying to convert him constantly to some form of Christianity. And he says, oh, you always try to get people when they're down, you know? It's just kind of like a play on that idea, but genuine struggle. Like when we think about Alcoholics Anonymous and various forms of AA meetings, whether it's drugs, sex, whatever, mm-hmm. that idea of struggle really, really comes up as a gateway to something greater. So that there's some exploration in there for me, and it's raised more questions and avenues, which I'll go off and explore on my own rather than bore anyone else with my meanderings. But I really liked your answer. I'd love to kind of move us on to the men's work piece. You know, that's kind of what brought us together initially a few years back. Mm-hmm. I'm no longer part of Manifesto, you know, your organization. That's just because, you know, I just decided to kind of drop out and do my own things. I found it really, really valuable. At the time, the guy that was the lead of the team or group that I was in was religious. I'm not sure if he was a father, but there were sort of religious figures within Manifesto, but it wasn't explicitly religious. And I've heard you say recently that it still isn't. And yet you've also, you've created a podcast now called, I think it's called When Iron Sharpens Iron, where you're really just diving into like sort of Orthodox Christianity. And there's been an about turn for you. And so I'd love just to hear what your thoughts on why you've started to invite more of that into men's work and how you see it has a place in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I've differentiated to a certain extent what I do internally and what I do externally in Manifesto. So for guys who come onto Manifesto Core, we have a really clear process of create a personal vision of what you want to achieve with your life or where you want to go, how you want your life to be. You set concrete goals based on that, and then you start working on habits that can take you towards achieving those goals and that vision. And we really try and avoid conversations with guys about religion inside Manifesto Core, because what we find is that people use it as an excuse to discuss a whole lot and not actually start working on their habits and their goals and making things happen. Instead, they get caught up in a whole lot of ideas and start thinking about that and find all kinds of reasons to not do that. So that does, you know, occasionally I'll have someone, you know, ask me questions about something regarding Christianity inside Core. And I'll say to him, like, you know, I'm happy to have this conversation, but it needs to be outside of the setting of Core, because I don't want it to distract from that important work. At the same time, we also created two groups now that have only Orthodox Christians in them. And those groups are super valuable to have. And it's really nice to have. And I can see how they, because you have a shared foundation of values amongst all of the members of the group, there can be a lot more direct challenge, and there's a lot more ease of being able to figure out, like, you know, what's accessible, what's possible to say, what's possible not to say, kind of thing. You know, you can, you know, that some things they're just shared values, so that makes it easier to be more direct with each other. You don't have to worry about stepping on people's toes in the same way.
Can I ask a quick question on that, just to dive in? Like, what might be shared values that you might have in that group that I might not identify with?
I'd say the most obvious one is the fact, like, Christianity is really, really radical when it comes to your sexuality. So basically, all of your sexual energy in a Christian context would be aimed towards either creating a lifelong relationship with one woman, or it would be actually aimed at coming closer to God. But using your sexual energy as a kind of for, you know, just experiencing short-term pleasure or a release of stress or something like that, it's not like Christian men don't do that. They probably do it just as much as other men do, but it's generally accepted that it's not the correct use of your sexual energy. And so we there's a shared understanding that that's what we do with it. So in other settings, it can be very challenging for men to even accept that idea, that it shouldn't, you know, they shouldn't just, like, you know, get a release of sexual energy from some way. Especially masturbation is, of course, the most common way that guys will release sexual energy by themselves if they don't have a partner. Whereas in, you know, in Orthodox Christianity, then you really have this goal. It's a very high goal. It's a very difficult goal to attain to. And I think as an Orthodox Christian, I'd say it's an impossible goal to do outside of a religious setting. Even it needs to have a spiritual dimension to it if it's to work at all, because otherwise it's too difficult to just do it through your own willpower. It probably will lead to quite a bit of dysfunction, actually, to just say, like, okay, no fap, and, like, you know, whatever, I'm just going to do everything else the same. Like, it that energy will go out some other place somewhere, right? So, but as Orthodox Christians, then we have a specific set of tools to work with and how to then channel that energy in a more productive way.
I'm wondering if it weren't dressed up, if you forgive the phrase, as Orthodox Christianity, whether those tools wouldn't be really useful to, like, all men. Because I kind of subscribe to these values that you just mentioned. I don't know if I was always ready to, and for sure I can relate to the struggle of not always being able to keep that energy in, if we kind of keep using that language. But you know, maybe less interested in going into the tools themselves, but do you think that they could be applicable to kind of men that don't have, like, a religious commitment?
I think it would be dangerous. I think that would be dangerous. Actually, I more and more I'm becoming clear that, like, it's actually Christianity is really a package. And so it's not like a kind of a smorgasbord where you can pick and choose. It's more of like it's more of, and especially Orthodox Christianity, I think there's lots of brands of Protestantism which are very much intertwined with the culture, and it's a bit more of a pick and choose thing. But Orthodoxy, I really think it's something that needs to start at the very root of your being, in like the root of your heart somehow. And it demands, it's kind of like an all or nothing thing to a greater degree, I would say. So I wouldn't recommend anybody. Actually, it's funny because I'm seeing more and more all around me people taking elements of Orthodox Christianity. It's very popular to say the Jesus prayer and to use icons and stuff like that. So you say, like, oh, these are the nice things I like, I'm going to leave out the other stuff. And actually, I think that it's a bad idea. I think it's better to rather decide on the truth and validity of the entire package. And if the whole package is true, then take it. But if you don't find that truth in the whole package, then I think it's better to continue looking for what is the actual truth then. Because if the foundation of it isn't true, then or it doesn't, you know, ring true in your heart, then I think it's better to continue searching until you find that, instead of just looking for little, you know, plasters on the wounds kind of thing.
No, I really get that. Thank you. I really like that answer. I mean, I could speak as much as I know about kind of the path of yoga, which is not that much, but you know, the certain path that I took for a few years was, it taught me a lot, and I have friends that could speak at length about this, but they would say the same thing. There are certain practices and there's a certain approach that and it just speaks to this idea of choosing a tradition and committing to it. And I heard you in a podcast recently talk with Alexander Bard, and one of you, probably in agreement, sort of lamented of how with these Eastern traditions, we do just kind of pick and choose, because they do seem a bit more flexible in that way. And they do seem a bit more open for us to kind of just pop over there, so to speak, and just help ourselves to these pieces. And that suits where I think we are today in terms of no limitations on who we can be and you know, no sense of sacrifice. It's just help yourself and continually, you know, grow in inverted commas. But actually, I think the opposite is happening because there's a lack of commitment. There's a lack of, well, maybe faith, actually, in what you're actually subscribing to. There's a huge problem with that. So I'm with you.
Yeah, it's like you need to put something in the center. And so when I'm doing the pick and choosing and just taking things, then there's a tendency that my entire, everything that I do then becomes centered around me because I'm the one who's choosing. And so there's no limitations. I'm just doing what I feel like, what I want. And so we are, I think we have a natural tendency towards narcissism and to selfishness. You know, I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. It's pretty clear. Like that's, it's a hard thing to get out of them, right? Like they're very interested in themselves. They're not interested in their brother having the nicest toy or the biggest piece of ice cream or whatever it is they want it for themselves. And so this is something that, you know, religious traditions help you to overcome, to grow as a human being, to gain, because it's actually a very incorrect view on reality to see yourself as the most important thing of reality. Because of course, you know, Paul Robeson is not the most important thing in reality, but it is my default position when I'm 3 years old, and it's pretty hard to get rid of and overcome as well. But when I start to overcome it and see how I'm just a very, very small part of reality and not a very important part in that part, then I actually start seeing things more the way they are, instead of in this distorted lens of me, everything's about me and it's all about me. And if somebody does something or they're offending me or they're somehow trading on me, my, you know, disrespecting me or something, you know? So you know, I'm still struggling with this every single day. You know, my wife says something that doesn't fall into my own image of myself as being like, you know, the theological educated person in the family, then I get offended and upset, you know? So, it's something that is not difficult to do and takes time. But that's, I think, what is at the center and the heart of a lot of these traditions is actually correcting our distorted understanding of reality. Often, you know, it can be the opposite as well. Some people, you know, we swing towards kind of narcissism or self-hate or something like that. We swing between those two things somehow. It's hard to gain the right balance.
I'll continue with a kind of impossible to answer questions, but you know, I'm with you. Like how to then move beyond this when, as I described, society is moving into that kind of, it's all about me, the individual versus the collective, and the individual is very much winning, I think, because of a lack of meaning, and they'll find that meaning in through some form of tradition or religion. And yet that's not where we're looking. These things are ancient. These things are decrepit. You know, I can relate to those views, and there are aspects of all of these that don't fit in, like their views towards homosexuality in some religions, etc. They're troublesome. And so it's like, there's no one sort of package that does seem approachable in some way, unless you then agree to their tenets. So it's like, we're not willing to look back, it feels like. So how to step out of this? Someone like Alain de Botton, who founded the School of Life, is a great sort of philosopher and thinker, has written a lot of books, and he's trying to kind of take the best bits of religion and what was truly useful out of it, if we're not going to buy into that as a secular society. And look, these bits are still good. And I wish that would take off more than it did, but where do you see things going? Like what's the answer, Paul Robeson?
Well, I mean, we can go back to where we started, I think, which was celebration. But I think that the secular project or the humanist project of celebration is always going to fail because, you know, at the end of the day, you need a story which really unites people into something higher. And the secular story is really centered around, at the end of the day, nothingness. There's no meaning. There's no purpose. The universe started as a big bang, and it's all just these random particles moving around. And what a human being is just like random organic processes that started back in the big bang. And they're just like predetermined. Everything's, you know, there's no foundation for meaning, for purpose, for truth even. You know, it's like in the evolutionary story, then truth is just, you know, like, it's just about what helps me to survive. So, even present day physics today will tell us that, you know, physical matter of like, you know, things that we can touch and feel and measure, that's only like about 7% of the reality. Most of it is actually dark energy and dark matter, which we can't even measure. We don't have contact with it. So it's like, how can we actually talk about reality from a physical evolutionary perspective We can't even sense most of what's out there. We don't know what it is. We know that the science from 150 years ago, we kind of laugh at that today. And 150 years from now, we're going to laugh at the science we have today. So what is the foundation for truth? Well, COVID vaccines, everybody gets COVID vaccinated. We need whatever it is, right? The current hot topic of the day. So there needs to be a higher transcendent story that we can all be united around and celebrate together. And that's what the Christian story provides for us. It's a coherent story that brings all people together and gives us a vision of human beings, not as something originating from slime, developing into amoebas, developing into monkeys, developing into, it's all too much evidence. If I look around me and I believe that we're just animals, right? Then I can really just see the things that are happening in the world and get that confirmed. And it can become quite a negative story about my belief. And, you can quickly go down the black pill kind of route if you have this belief about reality, right? Whereas as a Christian, we believe that man is created in the image of God and that our essence, our nature is to be reunited with God. And so it helps us to, as I'm celebrating the feast days, which is the story of man's uniting with God, then that becomes the most central thing that I can meditate on throughout my life and through these celebrations. And so I see that story happening around me in my own life and in the people who are closest to me in their lives as well. Because, the story we just had of the Annunciation is that this angel comes down to Mary and says, you have been blessed by God. We believe Mary was a very pure person. She lived a very pure life. She was dedicated herself fully to God from the age of 3. She lived in the temple and was dedicated to God. And so because of that, Christ was born inside of her body. And so God himself was born inside of her. And so by following her example, she only said one thing. Well, she didn't say only say one thing, but she said to the angel, she said, "Let it be done." She said, "Behold, I am the maidservant of the Lord. Let it be done to me according to your word." So when we're able to say to God, "Behold, I'm your servant. Let it be done to me according to your will," then Christ can be born inside of us as well. That's the understanding of it. She is the foremost of the Christian saints, the highest in the hierarchy of saints, because God was born inside of her as the first human being.
I really like what you're saying. I'm trying not to let this get into a kind of science versus religion conversation. I want to reconcile a couple of things, and you can perhaps shift my perspective like you did a year and a half ago when you said something else. Like when you mentioned this whole thing about us coming from slime and then, from monkeys, science says we did, and I struggle to think that there's another way to explain that. Are you saying that actually, no, the Earth was created in 7 days, or are you acknowledging our evolution and kind of talking about the Christian story as a story, and that it's important to understand it as a metaphor and not to be taken literally, because then otherwise I can't reconcile these two things.
So it depends what you mean by science, Richard. There are different approaches to science. One approach to science, which is the primary, at least popular science of today, is that all explanations have to be naturalistic explanations. So we refuse to accept any non-naturalistic explanations. So it has to be a mechanical, naturalistic, physical process that we can observe and document. Otherwise, we exclude it from the beginning. So this is science that excludes God as a possible explanation. So if you mean science has to exclude God from the beginning, then obviously that there's your science is then going to go and look for explanations, and it's going to find explanations that are opposed to the idea of a God. But there are plenty of scientists. In fact, all of the people who invented the scientific method didn't exclude God. They actually believed in God, and they didn't see any incompatibility between. They would actually evaluate kind of religion, so like all of scientific theories are informed through an intuition, an idea, some kind of idea that somebody has, and they go in and explore them. And so one of the possible sources of religion, of scientific theories, would be from religious understanding. Scientific theories are something that come from above, and then we investigate them in the data. And so religious ideas can also be investigated in the data. But that's become very unpopular today. So if you're a scientist, a natural scientist today, and you kind of want to explore, kind of geological or biological ideas based on a kind of belief in God, then you get quite quickly excluded. It's seen as, and there's a very polemical discussion in the United States, especially in other places on that. But I think that, as I said, like our scientific theories that we have today, like they will different in 150 years and we don't know in what direction they'll be. And I don't think there's a, I think good science wouldn't exclude the supernatural. I think that, you know, there are many scientists today, even Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris entertain ideas about aliens coming and, you know, instituting life on Earth. So because aliens aren't supernatural there, but it's like, you know, it's like, well, what's the difference really if it's aliens or if it's God, you know, like it would be a very similar thing, right? It's an outside thing, an intelligence that's coming and kind of instituting something on Earth as well, right? So, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm making sense here.
You are. My initial question still remains unanswered for me in that the whole, you know, are you kind of claiming that the slime, but the, you know, the evolution as we understand it through Darwinian understanding, is that still true? And that the story of God can fit on top of it for you?
I think that Darwinian evolution, as kind of explained by Darwin, has been generally discredited by modern evolutionary scientists, like in their specific claims and ideas. I'm not into the details of it, that have kind of been discredited, but one has updated the model of evolution now with new explanationary models of how evolution happens and different ways that it's happened. But there are definitely clear contradictions between the Christian story and the modern evolutionary framework, especially when it comes to the origin of life. So if evolution, you want to talk about microevolution, like, you know, within the same species, then that's clearly something we all agree on. But then as you go back towards, like, you know, trying to explain greater and greater things and like the essence or the nature of what humans are, then there's very clearly large contradictions that are, you know, I think a lot of Christians, you might even find today, a majority of Christians in the West might even agree with evolution, but most of them haven't really thought about it very seriously, I think. And I think if you, as a Christian, really do look into these things, then you will find reason to be unsure about things at the very least. One of the claims that, one of the assumptions that evolutionary theory also builds on is the uniformity of all of the natural laws throughout all time. So since the Big Bang, all natural laws have been exactly the same. But in the Christian story, then actually with the fall of man, some of the natural laws changed. And so I can, it'll be a very long conversation. I can try and give you a little bit of an overview of what that meant, but death entered into the world in the Christian story at the fall. So death didn't actually exist. Adam and Eve were born in paradise. And so the way that the church fathers see this is that Adam and Eve lived somewhere on a higher plane. Paradise, we believe, still exists. St. Paul was caught up into paradise, but we believe that it was less coarse. Like the physical reality that you and me live in today is more coarse than the kind of reality that Adam and Eve lived in. So there was and it only came more into being through the fall. So this is the understanding of the Christian story, and it's not written as a scientific explanation. So it wasn't written as a scientific textbook. So it's hard to know what that means. We don't, it's not something we can grasp necessarily with our rational mind, but I believe that as science progresses, it's going to give us more and more hints to that. I think that we'll go through paradigm shifts in the scientific understanding that will help us to come closer to understanding it if we're open to that kind of understanding.
My sense is that we're kind of leaning more in that direction. There's a lot bigger questions being asked. There's a lack of trust in institutions for various reasons. And you know, there's always been literature out there, like the Atlantis Blueprint, and more recently this Netflix documentary. I forget the guy's name, but it's called Ancient Apocalypse. And I've read a few of his books, and they're kind of really entertaining yarns. I mean, I don't buy it because there's not enough evidence there for me, but it's so interesting as an idea to kind of imagine where we actually came from. And it even starts to question a lot of what you're saying in these kind of higher planes. And why not? It's interesting, but I agree that science is kind of archaeology generally like, no, thank you. You know, it's a very specific viewpoint. I kind of I want to shift gears into talking about masculinity. It's we're very good at sort of diving into these smaller topics, or much bigger topics, excuse me. But interesting to our listeners also, I think, is this question of what masculinity is. And you know, you clearly write on your website that you're all about restoring masculinity. I'm about redefining masculinity. So, you know, maybe there's a conversation there, but like, let's start with what you mean by restoring it.
Yeah. So if you're asking me as a, again, like inside Manifesto, I'd probably in core, if someone asked me that question, I'd answer differently. But being on a public podcast, I'll answer in the deepest and more honest way, which is that like, I do believe that man is created in the image of God. And so we have a divine nature inside of us. God is not a man. He's not a woman either. but man was created. Humans were created. Man was used before as a word for men and women. We were created man and woman, and these two things are like, you know, a mystery in some ways. It's hard to understand. There's all kinds of different writings within the church about what that means and how that comes together, but it's very mysterious, and it's not easily grasped through language, and rational explanations especially are difficult to grasp it. But it seems like there is certainly some kind of, you know, masculine feminine relationship between men and women, which doesn't correspond exactly to, you know, our biological gender all the time. And these things are a part of the divine order of things. And they indicate a deeper truth and a deeper understanding of reality as we understand them better. And in my experience, I understand it more and more through the relationship with my own wife, who I've, you know, kind of like have dedicated all of my life towards building a family and building intimacy and closeness with her. Then I understand these things in a more, you know, in embodied knowing way, more than a rational way, I would say. And it's more like I lose the ability to be able to talk about it from that knowing, rather than, you know, I used to be 5-10 years ago, I could spout off all my theories and ideas, but these days I have much more respect for it as well. But yeah, when I say restoring masculinity, then I would say that it's restoring that godlike image in ourselves, of actually becoming closer to God, becoming more in that being of God, and that is a whole host of things which we normally recognize and call virtue, truth, beauty, justice, compassion, these kinds of things. Those are the things that I think is what masculinity has always been. I think we've had high resolution pictures of it and low resolution pictures of it. If we go back further in time, then it was more difficult. You know, there was a radical shift certainly when Christianity came onto the scene, compared to, you know, the Roman Empire before that. Then, you know, you know, humility wasn't really seen as a thing. Compassion wasn't really seen as a thing. If you went and invaded another country and, you know, took everybody's slaves, you were a hero and a strong man, right? And today we look down on that kind of thing and just in general tyranny and oppression and domination far more negatively. Christ's Sermon on the Mount was something that seemed to really change humankind forever. He, you know, that there was a radical inversion that happened in our understanding of being in human being through those words that he spoke, which seemed to have just resonated throughout the ages somehow and haven't lost, you know, today they're just a part of the culture. We don't even notice them anymore because they're so ingrained in who we are and the way we see the world.
I like the virtues or the qualities of masculinity that you mentioned, but I'm wondering, like, then what qualities are left for femininity? You know, because you mentioned a kind of a nice mixture of sort of virtue. I forget now, apologies, but compassion was in there, humility, you know, a few pieces. And it's like, okay, well, then what's femininity? Is it a different set of values? Is it a different flavor of them? What does that mean to you?
Yeah. Certainly there's a different flavor to masculine and feminine. It's
qualities.
More of a question of emphasis than what it contains, I would say. So there's definitely a higher degree of emphasis on compassion and receptivity, humility, and less on strength and kind of stoicism kind of thing. but bravery no less, absolutely. I think femininity is just as much courage, shows just as much, like the heroine is often far braver than all the men, right? And as the hero is obviously a central aspect of both of them is having courage. But the heroine is often far more hidden somehow. And the male hero, there's a lot more glory and external kind of recognition to him, whereas the feminine, her job is often more behind the scenes, and not as visible in some ways. Certainly just as important, you know, there's that saying that behind every strong man is a far stronger woman. And I think that's very, very true. But the feminine strength comes out in a different way. I really like the way Jonathan Peugeot talks about, like, the feminine as kind of like setting the frame where the masculine then answers the question somehow. And so she kind of like creates the space of possibility. The feminine creates the space of possibility, and the masculine then acts out whatever it is that needs to happen. So there's that movie, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, where the daughter wants to go and study university, and the father says no, and then he goes to her mom and says, oh, mom, like, you know, dad's the head of the household, and he's now, he said no, and what are we going to do? And so the mom says, don't worry, my daughter, you know, the father might be the head of the house, but the mother is the neck, and the mother, the neck decides which way the face, the head has to look. This is something that I can just see so much, like, you know, the depth to which my wife forms and shapes our life as a family in subtle ways by creating the space where our life unfolds is so deep and fundamental compared to, like, I sometimes make, like, oh, we need to do this as a family. We need to, like, go on more walks together or something like that. Like, I can do these certain things, right? But she sets the whole frame where the whole, you know, she, you know, there's something else that she does that really is more powerful in a way. Like, but men are far more like instrumental and directed and rational, whereas women, there's another type of intelligence, or the feminine is far more flowing in some ways, right?
I guess I want to come to this sort of how then we restore masculinity piece in a minute, but, like, just to kind of understand, is it possible / necessary / healthy to then kind of learn or the opposite qualities? Are you saying that the feminine's kind of more subtle way of turning and steering and directing this kind of men / masculinity is not something that can be learned by men, is not appropriate for men, and vice versa, this kind of, you know, more instrumental approach, is that not for women somehow? Because I feel like where we're going, or where we are now, is that women are like, well, I'll have some of that, please, and you know, we're sort of changing and evolving, and so, yeah, what are we trying to restore? And is that the emphasis?
Yeah, I mean, what I meet is a lot of guys who are, like, very soft and flowy and feminine, and really just actually still boys who really want to get into their feminine side and explore their feminine side. And they do it mainly because it's very pleasurable and enjoyable, and because it means they don't have to take responsibility for their lives. So that's where I can see that question can kind of go wrong. But obviously, we want to become fully balanced human beings. And I, in my life, have experienced, and I really see that the place where I do that the most is in a marriage. So I actually just had this conversation with another guy who's about to get married today. He's not getting married today, sorry, but in 1 month he's getting married, and I spoke to him today. And we spoke about that in a marriage, especially early on, you don't want to be sharing all of your hardships and difficulties with your partner, because you're going to come across as needy. And she wants to be able to lean on you. And if you're trying to, like, get your needs for emotional stability met from her, you're kind of wanting her to become your mom. And that's really unattractive for a woman. And it's going to, in the long term, make her feel unsafe, because she's like, well, if I'm feeling all kind of, like, confused and not sure about things, and he's feeling the same, like, what the hell are we doing here? Like, who's the one in charge of things? So as a man, you don't want to lie and deceive somebody. But what you want to do is have other good male friends who challenge you, who don't offer you just sympathy, but who help you to grow in your masculine, so that when you then meet your female partner, that you can already have that clarity and conviction and, you know, strength of purpose and direction in your life, so you know who you are and where you're going. And that's what's going to make you very attractive for a woman. And then when you have that and you meet her in that space, then woman, bring in all the kind of other stuffs of life, and a relationship with a woman obviously does this. And then you balance each other. You know, you and so when you meet a couple who've been together for 50 years and they have continued, you know, they haven't frozen and got stuck in roles, but they've continued to grow in intimacy and depth of connection together, then what you'll find is that they're actually very much on a wavelength with each other, and they have that balance in their lives as well. A couple who really love each other deeply and support each other.
I guess I'd love to hear what you think about, like, it's got to work the other way around, because I'm not interested in purely holding the capacity for a woman to come along into my space and just be kind of like needy and dramatic and not have her shit together at the same time. And this is the danger, I think, of this. I'm not sure it's the argument you're making, but this is the kind of misunderstood idea of the masculine holding the space for, like, to be able to hold a woman through. It's like, I just don't want someone that's that demanding. And it's not about men and women. It's, I just don't want someone that's not got their shit together. I was very needy in the past, and I understand and agree with everything you just said around needing to have that, other men to kind of like challenge me, and just to have my shit together is my kind of universal phrase for it. So that this, my partner is like, okay, I can trust this guy. He's, you know, I don't have to become his mother, but equally I don't want to become a woman's father, and just to, yeah, like, you know what I mean? So unless that's said at the same time, this argument or this yeah, thought process holds no weight for me. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, you don't want to meet someone who's just like a basket case, and it's not worthwhile creating a relationship with somebody who's constantly in need of help and can't do anything by themselves, obviously. But what I found is not so much where you are when you start. What's important is having a shared destination. Like, where is that you're aiming? Can you agree on where you're aiming together as a couple? And are you both motivated to move out of where you are at the moment? Because at the end of the day, I not only just in my partner, but also in friends and people, other people in my life, you know, I really just noticed, like, when you see someone growing as a human being, it's incredibly motivating to be with that person. And it doesn't matter if they're, you know, a drug addict or dealing with all kinds of other problems as well. If you see them overcoming their demons, it just gives so much life and energy. And you also start believing in the continued growth as well. So there can be a continued. So what's worse is, you know, it seems like, you know, stopping in your growth. That's what death is as well. So for me, the easiest and most clear way to do that is to find a woman where you agree on what God is and who God is. Because if you do that, then God is obviously the most worthwhile thing to be able to approach together. I normally say, like, you know, if you're two human beings and you want to approach each other this way, we actually lack the ability to do that. We can't grow in intimacy by just looking at each other. And I really experienced that in a very concrete way with my wife, because we just see the world differently. So sometimes I have these conversations, I'm like, you know, I know I could do this with a man, like, he would understand me, but my wife, we just see the world differently. And so we just can't bridge this gap. But if we turn our vision upwards and we can agree on something up there, then, and we want to approach that together, then that brings us together. And so it's important that, you know, I find it as a man, like, I'll often feel like I'm bearing the heavier load, but I guess I'm sure my wife feels the same. I'm sure she feels the same as well. And if you look at the statistics, actually, so men who get married will live far longer than men who don't get married. They have far longer life. They earn more money. They are more successful in their careers and their academic studies, and, you know, pretty much every drug addiction, alcohol addiction, all these things, they perform better in every single statistic. Women who marry, they actually live slightly shorter than in most Western countries. They actually live slightly shorter than women who don't marry. And that's the case in Denmark and most of the Western countries I've seen.
Why would you even share that? That's almost like, don't tell them. this works for men, but it doesn't work for women, is kind of what that tells me. Like, why is that?
I think it does work for women, but just not in, if your only goal is to live as long as possible, then obviously it doesn't. But I think that there are things that are more important. I think men do, we're worse at creating network and connections and kind of social stability for ourselves. So we suffer far more when we don't get married. Yes. We really, really can crash and burn. The years where I was the most off targets, that was my years where I insisted on not creating a, you know, monogamous relationship. Then I really went off on crazy stuff. I think women who marry will more often have children and will dedicate a large part of their life on supporting their children. We still have incredibly high expectations of women these days and being career women at the same time that they're mothers as well. So I think a lot of women are burning themselves out on that. So
that almost takes the approach that is kind of more, the weight is more on them. Is that kind of what you mean by that? Because I mean, you could again apply that to men and women. It's like, it's harder for men and women to kind of keep intimacy up and you know, raise a kid if in today's society in general, unless perhaps there is like a shift where it's like one person, you know, chooses to focus more on the upbringing, one person tends to bring in the bread, but that's not kind of a popular view. And it's not kind of a reality in terms of economics these days either.
Well, I just want to address that directly, actually, because I don't believe that's true at all. I think it's a story that we tell that props up a unnecessarily high consumption level, because basically I think our consumption levels just follow our income levels. And that's it, the amount of money we're earning today is far higher, and the standard of living is far higher than what our parents or grandparents experienced. So in very early on in our relationship with my partner, long before we married, actually, I just said to her, like I said to her, as long as we're together, I want it to be that so that you don't need to work if you don't want to. I just said to her, like, I don't want you have to, I want it to be so such that you don't have to work. And that very quickly led her to not working. It's very clear to both of us that she's far happier not working, especially since we had children. It's not like I earn piles more money because she's not working. It just means that we don't consume so much because we've had to set up our lives that way. But I think our life is actually far more enriched from having that far lower consumption than if we were able to buy far more stuff than we do right now. So I actually don't believe at all that story that you have to do it today, because I don't do it and I'm not earning more money than most people. I promise you, I earn less than what the average Dane works earns, absolutely. But we have, you know, I have three children and a wife and a home and everything that we need to support. But yeah, we don't buy. We have to get by with less, absolutely.
I mean, I'm really happy that you made the choice to offer that to her and that she loved it and that she's happier as a result. And all of you are happier. Like, this is amazing. But I also wonder where a lot of women might not kind of want to do that, given kind of where we are as a society. I mean, you've got specific values that feel different. So a lot of women, I think, would be like, actually, no, I don't want that. And you're seeing women choose to have kids less. And you know, we can go into the kind of mm-hmm. costs and what the impact of that is and whether we think it's helpful or not, blah, blah. But there's mm-hmm. I feel that's because you guys have specific values.
Absolutely. And that's great. And that's why it's even getting to, like, we're already on the edge of, you kind of need to have the whole package of Christianity to go into having this conversation, you know, because it is a package thing. Like, I don't see it, you know, even just like there's a whole movement now, trad values. And so we had an Orthodox group called Also Bros, where we're kind of playing a little bit, where one of the guys started posting a whole lot of, like, he's like very, very new to Orthodoxy. He's not baptized himself yet. He kept on posting all these pictures of like trad wife and trad this and trad that and trad family. Which is like, you know, just the traditional family. And actually some of the guys said to him, like, please stop posting those, because we actually, you know, it is this thing of like trying to pull out something from a tradition. And then, like, what we believe is creating an idol out of it. It's idolizing some of the fruits of a specific lifestyle, but it's ignoring the suffering and the pain and the price that needs to be paid, because there is suffering and pain and a price that needs to be paid for those things as well. And so when you separate out these things, then you get a distorted picture of what's possible. And then people aim for the trad life, but then they don't have all the other stuff as well. And somewhere they're going to fall down and hit their face, or it's not going to work. And, you know, that's going to be frustrating. It's hard to separate these things out. And I think it's a good that you highlight that I think these things, I really believe, Richard, and the more I work in men's work, it's like, as I said, like, Manifesto Core works very much at a superficial, operational, practical level, but real change has to happen in a person's heart. And the only real change that can really happen in a person's heart is a reorientation of it towards God, away from itself or away from, you know, whatever it is. Like, normally it's idols that we're orientating towards. I believe that human beings are, you know, instead of Homo sapiens, the thinking being, we as Christians, we would say it Homo adorans, which is the worshiping being. We worship things with our lives. We dedicate ourselves. We don't behave rationally. And, you know, we're not homo economicus, absolutely for sure. And so we worship things. And everything can turn into a dysfunctional idol, whatever it is, except for something which, you know, we believe God is something that defies any qualities that you could put onto him as well. But it's something that can be revealed through the participation in the tradition and the services, the divine services of the faith.
Like, I don't have a problem with the word God anymore, but when you use it in that context, like, we have to shift, to looking towards God. I guess there's going to be other words for that. It has to be something. If I can offer an alternative that might be more accessible to some, shifting our attentions to something greater than ourselves, right? And whether it's a deity, but it has to really be in a tradition. I from my own exploration, and so it's a personal kind of share, like, I don't think it's enough to kind of look generally at kind of up at the sky and go, oh, the universe, and going into that kind of language. I don't think there's enough of a faith, or there's no tradition in that. It's just kind of self-help, sort of new age faux spirituality, which
it's very vague and open to interpretation. Yeah. So it's like this kind of open space that anything can come in full, right? Like, you know, like, and there's lots of things that can fill up that space. And it can be very random what it is that then kind of takes that, you know. Yeah, absolutely. So it's better than, I'd say, some of the secular worldviews, I think, which can become quite dark in some ways, because there isn't anything higher than the human, than the self, then in the secular worldview.
I found myself for financial reasons also kind of going more into kind of corporate trainings, because, you know, as you are also probably aware, men's work is not like it's not going to make millionaires out of us. men are less engaged, they're less willing to, and there's cultural reasons for that, but it's more of a passion project for me now. It's kind of, this will always be a thing for me, having been on my own journey, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But in stepping into working with one particular organization, like, who are interested in sort of perennial truth, and I love that phrase, meaning what was true like 1,000 years ago, mm-hmm. you know, maybe even before that, is probably going to still stand up in 1,000 years from now. And so you kind of reference something similar in the way that, you know, religion and tradition also, what's, I think you said, like, what's still solid, what's real. And they mm-hmm. kind of take the overlap between psychological frameworks, and you know, they need updating, but what's still true of them now today, going all the way back to kind of yogic philosophy and looking all around the world. They talk about, yeah, Christianity, like the Celtic cross, and what's kind of true about how the brain works, and inevitably at some point there has to be the look up that you mentioned earlier. It's just not about, like, you know, self-actualization, and it's still about the self. And I really get the sense now that it's just not going to be enough. It's not enough to sort of self-actualize. This is just kind of like empty language. There's got to be a look up to something greater than oneself. And from there to kind of find a sense of connection, belonging, and actually to give back. So, but they've also brought neuroscience in to kind of validate a lot of this kind of stuff, so that, you know, now I'm extra happy, because it's just kind of, you know, what I needed. And yet how to kind of bring that let's call it sort of fluffier edge, you know, into corporate, that's kind of always the challenge, you know. So that's not really what they're doing, but when you look at underlying models of their underlying models, then you can kind of see, when you meet them as humans, it's like, I wouldn't say that they're all Orthodox Christians or Muslims, but there's that general kind of, you know, there's that humility that I think is the kind of the key word that traditions and religions can do bring in. But I just wonder if it's possible, kind of, it must be possible without it, but what's the way forward for us to kind of tap into that, you know, like, because you're advocating for, not overtly, but you found your way, maybe that's a better way of saying, you found your way in through Orthodox Christianity. Are there certain kind of religions that you would, or traditions that you would advocate for, even if they're not your bag, you know, and then certain that you wouldn't? Or what are the options to people? Because I'm asking this extremely kind of wordy salad because you mentioned like that there's a superficial level for men to kind of just get their shit together with the goals, and that yes, 100%. And there's the piece that is so important for me that you mentioned is like how they can change their hearts, right? Mm-hmm. So like, what is that? What does that look like beyond Orthodox Christianity? You know, for you, it can't be the only way, right? So what other avenues of exploration can men have, or people, into this way?
There's so many, there's a lot of different ways I could answer the question. So Father Seraphim Rose, who I mentioned, wrote a book called Orthodoxy and the Religion of the Future, and in that he talks a lot about that, of the religious streams and various trends that were in the 70s and 80s that he was observing in his time, and how orthodoxy stands according to that. And so if someone wants to have a kind of a really deep dive answer to that question, I can recommend looking at the book Orthodoxy and the Religion of the Future. I will say, if you're living in the West and you're living in a Christian society, I think it's worthwhile to take some time to really try and look at why is the Christian story so prevalent and so ingrained in our culture? Why does it seem to be such a foundational thing for Western culture and society? You know, the state of Denmark was founded by a king called Harald Bluetooth, who made this big stone, and it's called the Jelling Stone. And he wrote, founded or placed here by Harald Bluetooth, who Christianized Denmark. And it has a picture of Christ and a very kind of Viking, you know, serpenty kind of Christ on a very Viking serpenty cross. So it was a very kind of Orthodox cross, the way we see it, at least. We also believe there was an Orthodox Christianity that was originally in Denmark, and only later on, that was in 1054 that the Great Schism happened and that, you know, the Christianity split there. So I would just encourage people to look into the roots of Christianity and go as far back as you can and see if you can get as close back to Christ as you can. If you believe and if you can understand that Christ is something special, something that changed especially our entire understanding of what is the good, the true, and the beautiful, that shifted with Christ. And so get us, because there's a lot of like churches today, which, you know, my grandfather started a church. He started a church in South Africa. There's like five, he died in 95, but there's like 5,000 people today who are still members of my grandfather's church. It's like, my grandfather was a pretty impressive guy. He played rugby for South Africa. He was very charismatic. But he wasn't as close to Christ as the original 12 apostles were. The 12 apostles were closer. So, you know, instead of looking at like, you know, what did Michael Ackley, my grandfather, believe in about Christ, try and go back to like, what did the original Christians believe in? And so this idea of sola scriptura, which is like only scripture, only Bible, it really limits people because you're not allowed to look at any texts from the same time that the Bible was written, except for the Bible itself. So all the other texts, there was, you know, the Bible wasn't the only book that was written 2,000 years ago. There was actually a very thriving culture in the whole Roman Empire. People were writing books all over the place. And the Bible itself refers to thousands of other works, of all kinds of different literary works from that same time and from, you know, long, long before. There's plenty of references to other literary works in the Bible itself. Even the Old Testament, you know, the Psalms, the book of Psalms refers to other ancient religious texts from all kinds of other religions as well. And so, if you understand the Bible, you have to be a part of a tradition which doesn't reject all of those other texts as well, which is what Protestantism does. Protestantism just kind of sees like, oh, the Bible fell out of heaven in the year 1500 when Luther went up and nailed these 95 theses onto a door of a cathedral in Germany somewhere, right? Like that's not what happened, actually. The Bible, the books that are in the Bible were only decided in around the year 340. It was a guy called St. Athanasius the Great. I actually have a chair. He was also called St. Athanasius the Hammer. He's the guy who originally proposed which books should be in the Bible. And before that, there was disagreements about it, and there was lots of discussions about it. And then in about the year 340, 360, he made this proposal, and that then became the canon of which Bibles. But there was plenty of other books that were seen as valuable and good, but just didn't make it into that final canon. And some of them were vital to understanding the content of the Bible as well. And so there's all kinds of references in the scriptures to all kinds of other literary works. And we can only really understand the scriptures in their original context if we can also look at those original contexts. And that's what the Orthodox faith is, the only faith. I'm going to make a direct plug here now, but you know, like it's the only faith that has had its express intention of preserving that truth, that belief. There's no mechanism whereby Orthodoxy can change. The Catholic Church has a pope. The pope wants to change something, he just changes it. And that's happened plenty of times throughout the history of the Roman Catholic Church. Whereas in the Orthodoxy, then we always rely on the interpretation of the Church Fathers. It's always the Church Fathers' understanding of tradition and scripture, that which is the one that we believe in. And it's proven to be far stronger against, you know, the culture that's washing over our society today. You know, the Catholic Church is really struggling with that. You know, they can't even, they're half there, you know, they have this massive problem with just like, you know, just like the idea that they introduced this idea that priests aren't allowed to get married. And now we can see like, okay, well, Catholic priests seem to have a problem with their sexuality, you know, and so that's a big issue. It's not an issue in of course, you know, it's not like there's never been a sexual scandal in the Orthodox Church. Any organization that's 2,000 years old is always going to have these kinds of things, but it's just not nearly the same kind of problem. So for me, going to the roots of things, you know, if you decide, no, it's not Christ, it's Buddha, then, you know, go look into that. If it's not Buddha or Christ, you know, maybe it's Ganesh or, you know, I mean, I just look at today, if I look at a picture of Kali, I'm like, well, that's a demon. Obviously, that's a demon. Like she's like has like men's heads hanging around her, like severed heads. She's dancing on the body of a dead person. Like, obviously, that's a demon. You want to worship that. Like, you know, what's she going to do to you? But I mean, you know, that's fine. If you want to go worship Kali, then go, you know, go get into that. It was a part of my journey. You know, it was a part of my journey. I worshiped. I was at explicit rituals worshiping Kali, and that was a part of what brought me out of the religion of secularism, which was the religion of spiritual death. You know, it's the complete denial of any kind of spiritual life whatsoever. It's the denial of spirit, and that's what secularism is. And so, I think it's important to seek truth where you can find it. Look for truth. Truth is impossible to resist when you find it and you're open to it. Most of the time we're scared of truth and we close our hearts against it. But if we honestly are willing to face adversity, face difficulty, face suffering for the sake of truth, this is the central word, I would say, of Father Seraphim Rose as well, and his approach to finding God is that he searched for truth and was willing to go against any taboos or any kind of you know, holy cows in society or political correctness, whatever it was, for the sake of truth.
A long, comprehensive advocacy for Orthodox Christianity, if I may say, you know, because my original question was, you know, what else? And I don't mean to mock you in any way. It's just like you just came really back to this because you fervently believe, like having explored, that this is truth for you. And this is, well, I won't try and sum up your feelings about it, but
yeah, I would go so far as to say like this is the most full truth, and there's plenty of truth also to be found in Zen traditions and in all kinds of other things, but I really do believe that Orthodoxy contains the fullness of the truth. You know, in Protestant, there's plenty of beautiful truths in all religious traditions. Otherwise, people would never follow them. This in like, you know, the Jonestown Massacre cult, whatever it was called, like there's plenty of truth that guy spoke as well, but there was also lies. And so, you know, so you're looking for the fullest truth.
We have a mutual friend that, you know, is heavily into Zen over in Norway. Yeah, that's a fascinating direction for me. I'm also just kind of drawn to those sort of, I don't know anything about them, but traditions of, you know, sort of Taoism, et cetera, over in, you know, China and Japan. Like, have you kind of explored those at all? Do they kind of hold any weight for you? Is it just too far away? Because, I mean, there is a proximity relationship to where we're from and who we are and the culture that we grow up in. That's kind of what I mean. And yeah. I feel like sometimes we just run away as far away as we can. And I'm guilty of that in my own country. You know, there's so much layers tied up in that. But okay, I'll dive into this thing because it seems mysterious. But will I truly get to its depth? Like I think it's possible, but I wonder if, you know, if that's if people are aware of the kind of why they're reaching us.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I'd say similar to you, I dabbled in these things, and Father Seraphim Rose learned Taoism from a Chinese master. He found that Alan Watts was extremely superficial and that it kind of gave him a very pop version of Taoism. compared to what he was able to find from, because Taoism is also very humble, and Alan Watts was very much interested in the limelight. So there was a very different approach there as well. So he found that to be an incredibly powerful and beautiful kind of framework and understanding. And I think it is, I think there's a very powerful truth in Taoism as well. I think there's a lot of insight to be gained there, absolutely. I think that there's a book called Christ the Eternal Tao. Sorry, it's an Orthodox book, which basically shows how these things are interlinked and intertwined, but again, how the Christian story just completes things in a much higher way. I think that all of these things can be steps on the way, you know. Like for me, one of the biggest things that I did was going on a Vipassana retreat. And just the thing of being away for 10 days, not being able to talk to people and having to deal with my own internal monologue for 10 days. It was incredibly painful, incredibly difficult. And it made me realize how completely distracted I was, that I wasn't taking my own life seriously. I'm really happy I never stayed in Vipassana, because today I believe it's like, you know, a deceptive, manipulative cult that makes people like, you know, spiritually bypass and not deal with the problems in their lives. But it was a very important step on the way to get there. So it's like, you know, I think an important thing in all spiritual journey, and maybe I can say this in general as well, it's like, if you think like, now I found it, then that's when you're really setting yourself up for a big fall. So even in Orthodox Christianity, Richard, like, it's the built-in understanding of it is like, you know, I believe that Christ is truth, but me, I'm really far away from Christ. Like, I don't know Christ. I'm really, really distant from it. So I can share some of my experiences with you here. It's really like, you know, I try and remain humble to the magnitude of what I'm talking about, because I actually have a very, very dim view of these kinds of things. I feel like just understanding my relationship with my wife, like the more I look at it, the more I experience it, the more I realize, like, I don't understand what's going on here. I don't understand it.
Yeah, no, I'd really like a little boy that's
lost. I'm still trying to find my way.
Yeah, I have a friend who's a yoga teacher, and she's by far the most knowledgeable scholar of yoga that I've ever come across. She you know, she really knows her stuff, and she's come to a point where she's like not comfortable with, you know, the expression kind of yoga teacher, because she's like, she understands that what tradition means and just how grand and huge it is. And so, I mean, I don't want to kind of put too many words in her mouth, but she's, you know, kind of just stepping away from that, and just because she sees the lack of integrity around the world, you know, in terms of what yoga has now become. And so it's in a similar place, and just going, okay, this is huge. And yet it's a healthy
that's
thing.
One thing I would say for someone, maybe to answer your question, like if you're looking for like guidelines, like stay away from people who are mixing commercial interests with spirituality. Like someone who says they want to take money to teach you about how to reach the divine, like, you know, that's dangerous territory. That's why I'm really trying, you know, it's like, I don't want Manifesto to be competing with churches. It would be really dangerous if Manifesto Core started competing with churches. So I talk about my faith online, but I on Manifesto Core, like, if you want to talk to me about Orthodox Christianity, someone listening to this podcast, you know, it's like, I'm happy to talk about Orthodox Christianity. Like, you don't have to sign up for Manifesto Core to do that. I've had people sign up and then they want to talk to me about Christianity. And I say to them, no, if you want to be on Core, go on a Core and go do, set your goals and stuff like that. Talking about Christianity, then, like, you know, that's something else. It's not the same.
Yeah. Final question, because I kind of want to respect your time. We're coming up to 90 minutes now, at least of our kind of catch up that we've had pre-recording. My thoughts are gravitating towards the kind of rather lame question of, and so what now, what next? I feel like that feels a little flat based on kind of the, you know, where we've been, you know.
I'm coming to the UK in June, Richard.
Ooh, I live in Lisbon.
I want to go on a hike in Snowdonia, which is like a King Arthur country, and we'll be a group of guys going over there. And then I'm going to go visit a monastery over in Essex, which is where there is a man who's, if he's not a living saint, he's close to one at least. And he's a disciple of a man who has been glorified as a saint, who died in 94. So this is the John the Baptist monastery in the UK, who has a Father Zacharias, or an Elder Zacharias, as the kind of spiritual father of the monastery. So you don't have to come to both. There's going to be also non-Christian guys probably coming on the hike. Richard Batty, I don't know if you ever got to meet him, but a highly intelligent man who in many ways resembles your way of approaching life as well, I think, who I think you guys would appreciate each other. Anyway, but that could be an opportunity to get to see each other again, because I really enjoyed seeing you last time at the, was it in 2002? Or you were last at the European Men's Gathering?
2022, yeah, year and a half ago.
Yeah, sorry, 2022, yeah.
It was. I can probably find my way over there. I'm based in Lisbon now, which is kind of like a Catholic country, so less, not so interesting for you. But it'd be great to see you again. I mean, yeah, let's just kind of wrap up.
You know, you're not in London these days.
Rarely. Mm. No, it's too big for me. Lisbon is like just the perfect balance. I'm very happy here. I've got a place which I'm at now, you know, just an hour north in by the sea, where I can go surfing and escape the city. I have a partner. We love the same thing. So, you know, we haven't looked up, so to speak, just yet, but we're doing pretty good regardless. So we'll finish on that positive. And like, thank you for your time and sharing your thoughts and experiences. And as ever, it's been like, this is a real education and a pleasure. So love seeing you again. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. It's great talking to you.